Welcome to the Catchcast slot, where we're reliving a few of the most popular shows while I've been in Hong Kong chairing an international transit mapping symposium. Yes, there really is such a thing. Today we're replaying the third most popular Catchcast episode on the podcast website, the one that was all about a very unique Newport museum. So in today's edition, we are visiting a postal museum. Did you even realise that there was one? Maybe you'd been fascinated yourself by Royal Mail and its post boxes. Well, who would know about this and why? Today, we're honoured to be given a special walk around by the museum creator and owner, Arthur Reader. Well, thanks very much for inviting us, Arthur. Maybe you can start by showing us what's here in the museum.
First things first, my real interests are railways and buses and stuff like that. What got me into collecting postboxes, I've always had an interest in the generic term of street furniture, which is lampposts, it's bus stops, it's, you know, water pumps and everything. And I went to North Wales for a holiday. I went to see the little trains, Festiniog, Mount Snowdon, all that lot. And I thought, as a lot of people had mentioned a place called Rhyl, I'd go and see what was there. And unfortunately for me, there's nothing in Rhyl. It really is a desperate place these days. But it had a massive big station, four platforms, and it was really good old building. So I went and had a look on the platform, and all I could see on the platform was the outside edge of where there'd been a post box, where it'd been painted so many times. So I made a few inquiries, and I found out that the post box had been removed because it had been vandalised. It was dumped outside in a skip. So I went out and sort of looked at it, and I got some advice from people there, and I said, you know, look, what are you going to do with this thing? And they said, well, we're just going to chuck it away. So the question was, well, if you're going to chuck it away, can I have it? And the bloke said, well, give me 20 quid and you can take it, put it in the back of your car. I said, well, give me a piece of paper that says I can have it and I'll take it home. And I took it home, took it all to bits. I was quite surprised how well it was made. I found there was an awful lot of stuff written on it underneath about 100 odd years of paint. And it started me off. And I put a note into a magazine about it. And a bloke came out to see me and he said, do you want another one to go with it? Yeah, I think I could probably find another one. So I acquired another postbox. Then somebody else said, oh, I see you're collecting postboxes. I know someone who's got one in a yard in East London. Oh, okay, well, we'll go and have a look at that then. And it kind of sort of spreads from there.
How long ago was this, Arthur?
1994, when I lived up in Harrow in London. Since then, the collection's gone a little bit wild. We stand at 260 today. Well, that's what I count it as. I think there's a couple more than that, but we count it as 260. But we cover the length and breadth of the country. I've got the biggest collection. I've also got probably the biggest collection of Irish postboxes outside of Ireland. And they're all the grass green ones that you can see down on my left down there. I acquired box number 260, that is. That was this year. And it was a rare one because although that part of Ireland is no longer part of the UK, they continue to buy their post boxes from us. So obviously we made them better than they made them. Otherwise they wouldn't have been buying our ones. But anyway, that was quite an interesting one to acquire.
So they just bought them from the UK and painted them green?
Yeah. I mean, that one there particularly, it's got the Irish Post and Telegraph detail on it. But of course, up to 1922, all the Irish ones would have been red, same as the rest of the UK. And all they did was paint them green. Some places they removed the royal regalia. Some places they changed the doors for Irish Free State.
So taking you back a little bit then to the beginning of the collection in the 1990s, you said that one of your previous interests was railways. What made you jump from railways to post boxes, or are you still as motivated by both?
Yeah, well, I think as little boys, my sort of age group used to go train spotting. If I leant out my bathroom window, I could see the line from Marylebone. If I leant out my granddad's bedroom window, I could see the underground line to South Arrow Station on the Piccadilly. So I grew up with trains. Every year we used to go on holiday to Torquay on the train from Paddington Station. So the trains are always going to be there, but you can't get a train in your back garden very easy. That's the problem with it. You can go and look at it, but someone else owns it. It's like the kid at football. It's his football, you can't kick it. You see? So you got to sort of think, well, what can I do? My dad collected stamps and it was a bit of a nightmare for us. Stamps everywhere. And I always sort of vowed I'd never get involved in stamps. And what do? I get involved in post boxes instead. Crackers, isn't it?
Stamps are just a little bit smaller and easier to store, maybe.
They are, unless you was my dad, because this old collecting hobby must go into genes, I think. My older brother collected football programmes. He had masses of football programmes. And I mean, my dad had ice hockey programmes, because he used to play ice hockey, and all these stamps and stuff like that, and London Transport maps. It's a case of not knowing when to throw something away.
And do you think you've learnt that lesson yet?
No, I built a building to put it in instead. So I just chuck it up here instead. I don't throw it away. It all comes up here. And eventually I have to look for it.
Well, look, let's carry on having a look around the museum then. So you've started off with the one from Rhyl. What happened after that?
Right, after that, bloke gave me two postboxes from Guildford. One of them, which I mounted outside my front door for my mail. And then another guy, say, come along and he said he knew there was a bloke over in East London that had a pillar box. He was actually one of these guys who does the headstones, and he had it in a garage. So I bought that off of him. I had absolutely no idea what these things weighed until it was delivered to my house. And I had to call in the help of my brothers, brother-in-law, various people to try and manhandle this thing into my garden. The neighbours must have thought I was completely off my trolley.
What we see on the surface is a bit like an iceberg. There's quite a lot underneath.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, with the pillar boxes, what you've got is, if you look at one on the street, what you're looking at is probably two-thirds of it. There'll be another third of it in the ground, because otherwise it would fall over. I mean, most of these things will survive a reasonable vehicle strike. If you look at the ones that are mounted in a wall, you're only looking at really the front quarter of it, and the rest of it's all built into the wall. And so there's an awful lot of weight in there, and there's an awful lot of structure, but they're very secure. They stand the test of time. The oldest postbox I've got is one in the corner over there. It's from 1857. But anything Victorian survived two world wars. Anything Edward VII survived two world wars. So it's been built to last. Modern day stuff won't be anywhere near that.
You've got your 1857 there. That's your oldest one. Have you got many from the Victorian and Edwardian period?
Just look along this line in front of you. Wherever you see VR on a postbox, it's Queen Victoria. We've got quite a few on the Isle of Wight. The oldest postbox on the Isle of Wight, funnily enough, is another 1857 one. It's in a wall on the Mall in Newport. And a few years ago, when they were going to demolish the building that it was in, I got together with a bloke from Royal Mail, the developer and a builder, and we had a picture taken sitting on a pile of bricks with the postbox, and we got the developer to include it back in the new construction. And it's back there doing the same job as it was doing in 1857.
Strong stuff. So we're going to carry on walking around the inside of the museum. What can you point out of some of the big, obvious, good collectibles?
Right, VR, obviously Queen Victoria, died in 1901. Her eldest son, King Edward VII. So if you see ER with a V11, Edward VII. When he died, his son came to the throne as George V, 1910 till 1936. Then there was a bit of a hiatus, and we had a problem with a guy called King Edward VIII, who came along, decided he didn't want to do the job, a bit like Prince Harry, and then he disappeared to his pastures new, and his younger brother became King George VI, and he was the father of the late Queen. So when we look at GR with a V1, as King George VI, that's 1936 till 1952. So, you know, he had quite a long reign, and then obviously then we go from that to the old Queen, and we've got a new monarch at the moment. We haven't got many postboxes made for him, so last year I decided I'd have my own one made up. I got a brand new postbox, it's up the end there, and I got AJ Wells to make me a vitreous enamel plate, which is brilliant. There you go, just like that, King Charles. And that, believe it or not, is what now they produce, albeit in that other form, for the present king. So I was there first last year. I'll beat them to it.
And got the full collection. And the king that abdicated, was there never any postboxes made for him then?
Oh yeah, they made 260 of them. I've got a couple in here. I've got one right over here, a wooden one. And it's got Edward VIII on it. Outside in the garden, I've got a pillar box for Edward VIII, but it's not as rare as you might think, because the Isle of Wight has actually got two pillar boxes for his reign. Melville Street in Sandown and Green Lane in Shanklin. And also, if you look at Newport Telephone Exchange and Shanklin Telephone Exchange, you will see King Edward VIII, 1936, crown and cipher over the doors. So he didn't forget the Isle of Wight, did he?
Very much present.
He is.
Arthur, you don't just collect post boxes that have been up in the street, do you? You've got all sorts.
Yeah. Anything that's used as a posting facility is open to be collected. Hospitals, council offices, hotels, quite often they would have their own private post box, which would be emptied by Royal Mail. It in all respects a Royal Mail post box, but provided for private usage. Some of them are probably amongst the most ornate and the most interesting, and also some of the smaller ones are the most valuable, because they become antique furniture rather than a post box. But I collect anything. I mean, I've got in standing in front of us here is a collection of what we probably would call lozenges. They are the old green and red signs that you'd see outside a post office. I've been given a few of these. In fact, I came home one day and found the one from Gurnard Post Office standing on my doorstep. No idea who put it there. Don't know who to thank. Don't know who to give any money to for it, because I don't like having things for nothing. But somebody went to all the trouble of giving it to me. Thank you very much. I've got one from Ventnor. I've got one from Benbridge, Newchurch, Arrowton. I've also got one behind that one there from Hailing Island, which didn't go down very well with a friend of mine who also wanted it. And I've got it.
You have one out. And I think I saw one in Welsh as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Bear in mind, in Wales, you've got a different language for part of the country. So they have to have everything bilingual. So one side will be Welsh, one side will be English. They've done the same in Scotland. Unfortunately, I don't have a Scottish one, but then they're not that common up there. I've got the Irish ones as well, which are Gaelic as well as English. So if you're going to be serious about collecting, you can't just put your foot in the ground and say, I'm stopping at that point. You've got to have the lot.
These lozenges, you will probably be able to advise me better, but I'm seeing the Gil Sands typeface on these ones here and the double inline lettering from slightly earlier ones. Do you know much about the typefaces as well there?
And there's a third one there. It's like I've got a shadow on it. It's different ages. The red and yellow with the, as you're saying, with the inlaid, was done sort of like from the 80s through the 90s. And then it went over to this green and red and yellow, and now of course it's red and white. So they're forever changing, but I mean, I don't mind them, but obviously with the red and yellow ones, they didn't lend themselves to having the local name of the post office on it. But that also, they were an awful lot cheaper to make, and that's another story. But you know, when you're talking about money, these things, they can be very cheap to make.
Because I presume there's a lamp inside. Are they backlit?
Some are. Some have got internal light fittings, some haven't. It depends entirely upon the location and what they could afford at the time.
And behind us, we have even older post office signs, and these were made from enamel, is that correct?
Yeah, vitreous enamel from 1904 right up until they ceased production. A company called Garnier in northwest London, who happened to be Willesden, not far from where I used to live, they had the contract for supplying not only all the enamel signs for Royal Mail, but also for the London Underground and an awful lot of street furniture as well. I used to be able to go in to see their work, see them make it. The how that is all done is, it's like a dark art, really. But when you look at some of them, you think, well, how has it lasted that long? Because it's made to last. And that's what Wells do now down the road. They supply Royal Mail and the London Underground as well. So they last a long time.
Because the enamelling process effectively is glass, isn't it? It's effectively cooking glass to make the lettering and the colours.
Yeah. I mean, it's like everything you do. If you've got the cream colour and the red, that's just two colours, or the black and the white. But then you start adding a third colour in, the cost of it goes up by quite a bit. Original post office signs and collection time plates would have had the sign next collection in red, which meant three colours. So when you've got three colours, that's an awful lot extra on the cost of it. So they dropped it down to just white and black, and then in the late 60s they did away with the vitreous enamel signs altogether in favour of black plastic things with dymo tape on. And they've had so many efforts since then. They've even tried, got one in front of me here, they even tried engraving stainless steel, and of course it's just not practical. If you want to go to the proper stuff, vitreous enamel, proper stuff.
Yeah, otherwise it just doesn't last.
It's like this one in front of me here. When you look at it, the actual work on that, this plate with the red next collection, that's probably 90 years old, and it's almost as good as when it was put in the post box.
It looks new, it's still as shiny.
Well, it does, but it has been used because it's all chipped. But you know, it's just sometimes they get a bit more wear than other places.
These ones we were talking about just now, this kind of oval shape, can you describe where they would have been erected and where they would have been seen?
Yeah, what you would have had, certainly in the major towns and the cities, you didn't necessarily know where the post office was going to be. So they come up with this idea of mounting a sign on top of the pillar boxes to point the direction of the local post office. Sometimes it would just say post office. Sometimes it would have an address. Sometimes it's in Welsh. And other times, you know, you'd have just an arrow, like pointing to the nearest telephone or pointing to the nearest stamp machine. You know, they thought about things for the general public back in them days. These days, of course, all that's gone because everybody used to break them.
They certainly are very evocative. As soon as you see these things on top of a pillar box, it feels like something from the 30s, 40s or 50s, doesn't it?
And of course, obviously, if you get into the pedantics, when you look at these ones I've got up here, you might think they all look the same. And then you start looking at the scripts on them and you realise some have got no fletchings on the arrows. Some of the letters are changed. It's different companies making things, trying their hand, trying their luck. But Garnier used to get away with it and get it all. He used to get all the work.
Now, we're inside at the Post Box Museum, and we're going to go outside in a bit, and we're going to brace the wind to have a look around the standing ones. But is there a few other things here that you want to show us before we venture outside?
Yeah, like everything, there's always going to be a couple of oddities. I was very lucky to be given the Heinz factory from Park Royal in West London, their post box. They were a 24 hours a day, 7 day a week operation. They had their own post office and shop, and they made their own post box, and it is literally like a giant tin of baked beans. It's not my favourite box, but it certainly causes a lot of interest, and believe it or not, it's the only one I can physically get inside. I've done that for somebody to look out the aperture. I won't do it now. Arms and legs won't let me do it.
Not all post boxes were just for posting letters, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the Royal Mail obviously used to dispense stamps because the post office was part of the setup, and they produced post boxes. They started off in the 1920s by putting a post box with a stamp machine in one end, which I can show you in a minute. That wasn't very successful, but then they came up with the idea of bolting stamp machines on the side of post boxes, which was very successful. And then for indoor use, they made special setups with a stamp machine as part of it. The biggest issue, of course, was when they went over to book stamps, it wasn't so bad, but when they were on rolls of stamps, they used to get damp and they get stuck. People would lose their money and there'd be a lot of hassle. And then eventually Royal Mail stopped selling stamps. And that was the end of that. You know, end of an era, really.
Because the last thing you need is a damp stamp.
Well, it's no good. You know, they're all stuck together in a roll. Can't use them.
Right, we'll be back when we venture onwards outside. We're walking outside here in the grounds of the Post Box Museum. We've just gone past the Victorian hexagonal one, and we were also looking at these enormous ones here, which I think were built into the walls. Is that correct?
Yep, we call them coffins because of the shape of them. They are the large wall-mounted post boxes that, like the pair outside Newport Post Office and to the rear of it, and there's one at Totland and there's another one in Ryde at the post office. They are made for basically larger post offices. They work very well. Royal Mail don't replace them these days because they can cause structural damage due to the sheer physical weight of them.
And how many of these ones have you got?
Cool. I'm gonna stand and count them now. I've got a very rare Irish one on the end down there, one of only five known to exist, and I had one made, or I had the door made for an Edward VIII one, because none of them exist anymore. So I've got the best collection of them by far anywhere. I've been very lucky because a lot of these have been given to me by Royal Mail, basically, because they can't be bothered to break them up.
And just ahead of there, we have some not fully circular-shaped ones. Now, I remember these from my youth when I grew up in London. They seem to be a little bit broader than the average circular one. Can you talk about those ones for us, please?
Yeah, these are the London oval pillar boxes. People on the Isle of Wight, unless you've actually been around the mainland, would never have seen them because they never supplied them to the Isle of Wight. But they were originally a London design, and it was for London one side and other parts of the country in the other. It latterly became first class and second class, and they appeared in all the reigns apart from Edward VIII. And I'm very lucky to have four from London here in my collection. But of course, I wouldn't have had them here had they not all suffered significant damage. They would still be on the street in use.
Yeah, because they really do look quite sturdy. I would have thought getting one out of the ground is quite hard work.
Yeah, and it's also very hard work shifting them. I tell you what, three of us here would not be able to lift that cap on one of them. Very, very heavy. The Victorian one is by far and away the heaviest. It weighs over a ton, and you're not going to be moving that around by hand.
Now, people would probably guess what they're made out of, but are they all made out of cast iron, or there are some other materials used?
The majority of the ones up to, well, the turn of this century, made in cast iron. Private usage ones would be wooden ones. Some of the ones you see on the side of lampposts are a composite of steel and cast iron. The modern ones they're making now are out of supposedly stainless steel. But if you go and see the one at Freshwater Bay, it isn't lasting very well for stainless steel. So cast iron was by far and away the best bet, but they keep fiddling with it and they end up going back to cast iron because you can't beat it.
And as you were saying inside the museum, they are incredibly robust. I remember seeing the one after the Manchester bombing, and the bomb had gone off next to it and it still stands today.
Yeah, in fact, we can do this on the island. We've got a box in Cowes, and Edward VII has got a big lump out the bottom of it, which was caused by shrapnel in the Second World War. But by and large, unless you've really gone to great lengths to smash them up, they're quite robust. They normally do themselves more damage by falling over and breaking the canopies than they do by a vehicle strike. But of course, doors get broken easily. That's the trouble with it. And if you haven't got spares, you can't repair it. You can't really weld it that easily to use it on the street. We got one standing here in front of me, which is a freestanding large wall box. Now, this is a specific thing because during the Second World War, buildings would all come tumbling down. Quite often, if there's a wall box in the bottom of the wall, it would be still there, but the building's gone. So Royal Mail come up with this idea of making a base and sighting it on the street. So it was basically doing the same job as a pillar box. Some would get the signs on the top and stamp machines. There's still two of these in use today in London. Yeah, and there's one near Earl's Court and one at Putney. So they're the ones left still in use, but they've done very, very well. To be honest with you, I think Royal Mail could have learnt a lot from the people in the past, because instead of wasting these ones and chucking them away, they could have done the same thing by today's standards.
They could have had a bit more recycling.
Yeah, definitely. They could have gone back into service. Yeah. You know, it's a waste of money, but then you see, you don't have the foresight these days.
We're now walking towards what you called earlier on the Avenue, and for anyone who hasn't been able to come here yet, hopefully you will do, you have got a very long row of post boxes facing another long row of post boxes. This must be the longest row of post boxes next to each other anywhere.
Definitely. I mean, nobody would be as silly as me to do this. But, you know, I've added to this over the years. We've moved them around a little bit when other ones have turned up. I've bought a couple brand new because I didn't have them. It's one of them things, it's all about, in the days before computers, you had to phone people up and write them letters to talk to them. These days, you just get on the computer and ask somebody if they want something or have got something. But I had to do the miles, and I would have to drive up to places like Edinburgh to go and order something or to collect something. And that's how you would have to do it. I mean, we've got all sorts here. We've got square ones, we've got round ones, larger ones, smaller ones. You know, they come from all over the country. And I've been very lucky.
So after the hexagonal design, what came next?
Right in the corner there, there's a circular one. It's got nothing on it. We call them anonymous pillar boxes. They came in the late 1870s after the hexagonal ones. They were made up for 9 years without having any royal regalia or the post office written on them. And eventually they relented and they had Queen Victoria's details put on it. But of course, as you can see from the green one, they're very popular in Ireland because you don't have to alter anything.
And Victoria did eventually get her regalia on it. Was that something that helped the visibility, or did that make a change to how they were used in the street environment?
To be fair, I don't think the general public actually bothered to notice. There was very few areas in the country that actually ever made a fuss. Liverpool was one. They had their own special post boxes with a big crown on the top. But other than that, people just, they used to use them because it was part and parcel of your life. You didn't have a telephone, so you wrote letters and you went to the nearest post box. I can go to Willesden in northwest London to a road which my great grandfather probably built the houses in. My grandfather lived there, my father lived there, and that Victorian pillar box is still standing. So I've posted a card in it to sort of make it down to four generations using the same post box. Sadly, younger people are not so enlightened as us olders. I can't persuade any of my children to post in it or any of my grandchildren, but I'd love to, because then we'd have six generations all using the same post box. It's the romance of the post box.
Now, the classic postbox, I suppose, came a little bit after Victoria. What would you say was the kind of classic design of postbox?
Well, the circular design actually came out during Queen Victoria's reign, and it's just been perpetuated right up until we come to the 60s, when we go to buses with engines in the back and cars with no wings, and they came up with a square idea of a square postbox. And it was reviled. A lot of places refused to have them on the street. We've got a couple of sets on the island here. One by the old Shanklin post office where the theatre is. There's a double pair there. There's another one that's wrapped and out of use down the bottom of Newport High Street. And if you go to Upper St James Street, there's two single ones standing there, sort of like they don't want to talk to each other. But I mean, that's what you get with them. They're not very well liked.
We are going to turn around from the ones we're looking at here and face the other designs on the other side of this row. We're still in the grounds of the Postbox Museum on the edge of Newport, and we're having a look at some slightly more modern postboxes here, Arthur.
Yeah, I mean, it's like everything. You can't improve upon a very, very classic design, but people will try. The square ones, they were not very well liked, so they came up with a newer idea, which was actually by a guy called Gibbs, and he designed this thing that looked like a giant torpedo. But it was very successful in as much as it was very difficult to damage and also very difficult to force open. And they got everywhere around the country. We've got quite a few of these on the Isle of Wight. They're a two-piece construction, so you only got a body and you've got a door. The only trouble is the door is so heavy, it wears the hinges, and if the door hinge fails, the door drops off, postman's going to lose his toes. And that's the trouble. But they went to great lengths to put these around the country. The Scottish one I've got there has got a rocking horse on the top. That was when Royal Mail cared about their people, and that was outside a children's home in Edinburgh.
Nice. And next door to that, you've got one with a more modern post office direction sign on it.
Yeah, it's a cast iron direction sign, because they were still trying this idea of telling people where post offices were. And because the enamel ones were getting so badly damaged, they made them in cast iron, and they survived very, very well. There's not too many of them left around the country. For some reason, Torquay seems to have a plethora of them, but they've survived very well. And unless you go up there with an angle grinder or a sledgehammer, you're not going to break them.
Now, I'm going to talk about this one right in front of me in a second. Why did they paint them red?
Right, okay. Well, postboxes originally till 1874 were dark green. That was the reason. What they did, they went over to red because they weren't visible in the old gaslit streets. And we're starting to get a lot more vehicles on the streets, albeit horse-driven. So there was a lot more damage being caused, because they would be normally sighted probably in the middle of a road, somewhere perhaps where a bus stop was, or even a gas light. Sometimes they would sight the gas light on top of the postbox itself. But they were becoming a problem. They weren't particularly visible, so they went over to the red, and by 1876 they'd done it right throughout the UK.
And the one in front of us is not red.
No, well, you see, this is what happens when you try and privatise things. In 1980, Guernsey Post and Jersey Post separated from Royal Mail. Jersey Post stayed painted red. Guernsey Post painted their post boxes blue. They've had about four or five different shades of blue since then. When I came to repaint the one in front of me, I phoned up Guernsey Post and asked them what colour they were using today, and they said whatever they can buy in the local shop. So I've gone back to the blue shade that was on it when we went over there to see the Guernsey post boxes.
And there were blue ones in the middle of the 20th century, and I believe they were for airmail, is that correct?
Yeah, we've got a couple over there.
We've come to the other end of the museum grounds. What do we have here?
Well, right in front of us, we then link the two hobbies together, because I've got a railway postbox. This is the only one that was ever made by the Cheshire Lines Committee, which was a company in the late 1800s that had all the infrastructure but no rolling stock. So they hired in carriages and engines from the LMS and the LNER, and I was very, very lucky to acquire that. But it wasn't like that when I got it. It was in a dreadful state. It was in bits, and it had damage to it, and it had stood for 100 years in a very sulphurous atmosphere. So the actual casing of it's not particularly brilliant, but it survives.
And it's not red or blue, it's black.
It is black. That was the colour it was last in British Rail days. But when I stripped this all down, we found originally it had been green, and for most of its life it had been red.
Ah.
So, but latterly, probably from the 1940s onwards, it's been black.
Just walking a weeny bit further down towards the entrance of the museum, we have this rather fine example.
Yeah, now, we see what this is. In the late 1920s, they come up with this thing about about aeroplanes, right? So if you can take an aeroplane for another country, you could possibly put some letters on that and get them a bit quicker than sending them by boat. So they came up with this idea of airmail, and it was quite successful to the point where they started producing their own special airmail post boxes. If you paid the right amount, of course, on it, you could post it into the airmail post box. A blue van would come and collect from it, take it to, in the particular case of London, take it to Croydon Airfield, and it would be sent to wherever it needed to go to in the world. The idea was so successful, by 1938, they didn't bother to have special blue post boxes anymore. They did away with them because you could put the little sticker on it and it'd go, provided you paid the right money. But of course, Royal Mail didn't in them days waste anything, so all these blue post boxes were taken out and stored, and then in the post-war building boom they've ended up reappearing on the streets painted red. And we actually have three of them on the Isle of Wight: Apsheath Post Office, Binstead Post Office, and if you go round the corner from Binstead Post Office you'll find a pillar box basically built into a hedge in King's Avenue. That's also, them three were all XML boxes, right. And they'll have come over probably from Portsmouth in the post-war building boom.
Amazing. You've really got the whole range here, haven't you? I think there's a few more last things you want to show us.
Yeah, well, I don't think we should forget to mention the dark green colour that Royal Mail boxes were, but this is my oldest pillar box. This dates from 1861, and this comes from a place called Rodney Street in Liverpool, which is basically like Harley Street is in London. This one was actually originally sited outside the house where William Gladstone was born, but of course it was removed in 1963 because it was no longer big enough, and replaced with one of them big double ones like you got in London. But suffice to say, it was found in somebody's garden, and that's how I ended up having it. And I'm very, very proud of it. And someone's put a topper on the top, which is for me, because it was to celebrate my 70th birthday.
And the toppers, which have become very popular, were a big feature of the museum just recently, weren't they?
They certainly were. I think the ladies who do this sort of stuff, I can't give them a round of applause because I don't know who half of them are, because it's a bit secretive. But the work that they do is utterly amazing. And that weekend that we had here last week, they raised quite a few bob for the Alzheimer's Cafe in Cowes, which is a worthy cause.
Because a lot of work goes into making these toppers, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, with my big fat fingers, I would not know where to start. And I wouldn't have the patience to do all that sort of work. But these ladies, they turned up here. They even done all the modern ones I've got down here. I mean, these horrible modern things that nobody on the Isle of Wight will have seen because we've never had any sent over here, thank heavens. But they came down and they topped them as well. And it's pushing your luck a little bit with some of them things, but they did it, and hats off to them.
Hats off to the WI.
Yes, definitely.
What a great place to finish on. Thank you so much, Arthur, for showing us around.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. If anybody's passing, I mean, I've hung up my electrical pliers now, so I'm not doing so much, and we're home a lot more than we was. I can't believe how much work I've got to do here at home. I must have been not doing it for a long time, but I've got a lot of work to do here. But if people are coming by, walking or cycling, they're more than welcome to pop in. If I'm here, I'll show them around and let them have a look and see what stupidity can get you.
If you just love collecting daft things.
Exactly. Why couldn't I collect his stamps like my dad did?
Okay, so next time you're hunting for a post box, remember that there are over 300 here at the Postal Museum. Thanks for being with us today, Arthur. Hope you've enjoyed listening and learning as much as I have. Next week's Catch Cast is not to be missed.